This is issue number 768 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Bernie Wrightson's passing, the reboot of Magnus Robot Fighter, and some of our upcoming shows. Our comics this week will be Silent Night number 1, Magdalena number 1, The Flintstones number 9, and Gotham Academy number 7. In our liner notes this week will be House of Lords, The Saint of Lost Souls, the brand new album that's releasing today.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Bryant Henry here, as always, the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the snowman sweatshirted Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. A little tired. I was up late last night watching the World Baseball Classic.
And the USA pulled it out, huh?
That was an amazing game. And before I even start with the boring everybody with baseball,
right?
I think the one thing that I got out of that was apparently there's some issues going on in Puerto Rico right now. I don't know exactly what it was, but a lot of the players were talking about how this has really brought the country together and a lot of the violent crimes have stopped, where I guess during this entire period when the Puerto Rican national team is playing, there's no crimes, there's no anything going on. So that was a huge story right there. But after the Americans won, and they won 7 or 8 to nothing, the American team grabbed the American flag and ran around the field with it. And then when they got to the Puerto Rican players that were standing on the sideline still waiting, the Puerto Rican players all got up and started cheering and applauding. And it ripped my heart apart, because to me, that's what sports are. It was just an amazing thing to see. And it makes you sad that all the world's problems can't be solved with sports. And in the end, people running around waving their flag in the air.
Well, the thing is, if the World Baseball Classic puts good sportsmanship on display, then it's a success.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not the USA wins or whoever wins it. And this is the first time the USA has ever won the World Baseball
Classic?
Puerto
Rico hasn't won either, and the U.S. hasn't won, which is the shocker, because you would think between those two and you look at a lot of the nations, like Mexico usually has a good team, Venezuela usually does, the Dominican, all those guys got bounced very early. Israel had a team in there this year, which I was really excited about. So I think this is the third year. They do it every 4 years. But what an amazing game this was.
Yes, and of course it wraps up right before spring training ends for baseball, because we are heading into the season, which we will not bore you with right now, because I know people hate when we start with the sporting minute. But hey, sportsmanship.
That's what happens.
Right?
It's
like to spread the positive. Good sportsmanship, something to be celebrated here on Secret Identity. So, and a nice positive note to start the show on, because our news, unfortunately, starts with another passing of a longtime beloved creator, and that is Bernie Wrightson. His wife, Liz, posted this on their website the other day. "It's with great sorrow that I must announce the passing of my beloved husband, Bernie. Thank you for all the years of love and support. Here's his obituary," which she posted below. And I will read it to you, Matthew. "After a long battle with brain cancer, legendary artist Bernie Wrightson has passed away. Bernie Wrightson, born October 27, 1948 in Baltimore, Maryland, was an American artist known for his horror illustrations and comic books. He received training in art from reading comics, particularly those of EC, as well as a correspondence course from the famous artist school. In 1966, Wrightson began working for the Baltimore Sun newspaper as an illustrator. The following year, after meeting artist Frank Frazetta at a comic book convention in New York City, he was inspired to produce his own stories. In 1968, he showed copies of his sequential art to DC Comics editor Dick Giordano and was given a freelance assignment. Wrightson began spelling his name Bernie, B-E-R-N-I, in his professional work to distinguish himself from an Olympic diver named Bernie Wrightson, but later restored the final E to his name. His professional comic work has appeared in House of Mystery, his first professional comic work appeared in House of Mystery number 179 in 1968. He continued to work on a variety of mystery and anthology titles for both DC and its principal rival, Marvel Comics. In 1971, with writer Len Wein, Wrightson co-created the Muck Creature Swamp Thing for DC. He also co-created Destiny, later to become famous in the world of Neil Gaiman. By 1974, the year of my birth,
yes,
Matthew, He had left D.C. to work at Warren Publishing, who were publishing black and white horror comics magazines. There he produced a series of original work as well as adaptations of stories by H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe. In 1975, Wrightson joined with fellow artists Jeff Jones, Michael Kaluta, and Barry Windsor Smith to form The Studio, a shared loft in Manhattan where the group would pursue creative products outside of the constraints of comic book commercialism. Then he continued to produce, though he continued to produce sequential art, Wrightson at this time began producing artwork for numerous posters, prints, calendars, and coloring books. Wrightson spent 7 years drawing approximately 50 detailed pen and ink illustrations to accompany an edition of Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein, which the artist considers among his most personal work. Wrightson drew the poster from the Stephen King penned horror film Creepshow,
yep.
which is maybe one of the most iconic movie posters of all time, as well as illustrating the comic book adaptation of the film. This led to several other collaborations with King, including illustrations for the novella Cycle of the Werewolf, which the movie Silver Bullet was based on.
Good.
The restored edition of King's apocalyptic horror epic The Stand, and art for the hardcover editions of From a Buick 8 and Dark Tower 5. Wrightson has contributed album covers for a number of bands, including Meatloaf. The Captain Stern segment of the animated film Heavy Metal is based on the character created by Wrightson for his award-winning short comic series of the same name. Characters he worked on included Spider-Man, Batman, The Punisher, and he provided painted covers for DC Comics' Nevermore and Toe Tags, which I believe... Who do we know that worked on Toe Tags?
Tommy Castillo.
Tommy Castillo worked on Toe Tags. I think I have all four of those signed from him. Recent works include Frankenstein, Alive Alive, Dead She Said, The Ghoul, and Doc Macabre, all co-created with esteemed horror author Steve Niles, and several print poster sketchbooks series produced by Nakatomi. As a conceptual artist, Bernie worked on many movies, particularly the horror genre. Well-known films include Ghostbusters, The Faculty, Galaxy Quest, Spider-Man, and George Romero's Land of the Dead, and Frank Darabont's Stephen King film, The Mist. Bernie lived in Austin, Texas, with his wife Liz and two corgis, Mortimer and Maximilian. In addition to his wife, he is survived by two sons, John and Jeffrey, one stepson, Thomas Adamson, and countless friends and fans. A celebration of his life is planned for later this year. That's quite a resume.
It absolutely is.
If you're a horror fan at all, then you're familiar with his work. And even if you're not a horror fan, then you're familiar with Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And so I know that he and Steve Niles were extremely close.
Yeah.
Because I saw something the other day. Steve posted about that online. And I'm sure that has been a loss that has particularly affected him. Because I think, did he stop drawing over the past couple of years? I think he either had to slow down or either had to stop drawing at some point.
Yeah, he was – there was that Frankenstein one that came out, that black and white book that I think you and I were both reading that came out. And the issues came out slower and slower, and then it was almost like there was nothing for a while. And I knew he was sick. I just didn't realize that he was that sick. This is the sad part. We've met so many people. I'm pretty sure that I met him at a Big Apple Con some years back. And it just, you know, you think about like my introduction to horror was through the DC horror line. He drew so much of that between him and like Michael Kaluta. I mean, those were the guys that scared the bejeebips out of me for years and years and years. Love those guys.
I didn't know that they had a thing called The Studio. I mean, that was like a super group of creators well before the days of like Image and stuff like that.
And what those guys did when you were mentioning that, I was like, oh, Pacific Comics. Like they had Alien Worlds and I forgot the other one. There was a creepy one. But they had Pacific Comics was really Steve Jones or Jeff Jones, the Jones. I forgot which one it was. But he was the one that did this line and he had every person there. Richard Corbin was drawing. And that to me was some of the best horror comics that you'll ever, ever read.
Well, our condolences to his friends and family. Obviously, it is all too often that we talk about the comics industry losing – veteran, well-known creators, and he is another one that that will be missed. So, and unfortunately, we always seem to have these on our news segments every time. So, let's try to get a little bit more positive, Matthew. Do you like Magnus Robot Fighter?
First comic book I ever bought as a kid.
Well, tell me what you think about this news. Dynamite Entertainment is bringing Gold Key's classic Magnus Robot Fighter back for an all-new solo series with a different take on the character.
Okay, I'm out.
set in a near future that has humans and artificial intelligences working alongside one another in an uneasy symbiosis. Magnus is written by Kyle Higgins, who has also written Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and drawn by Jorge Fornes, who has drawn Amazing X-Men. The series focuses on Dr. Carrie Magnus, a psychologist who works with recalcitrant AIs. The first issue will feature a Turok backup story by Chuck Wendig, who is a very well-known author who has now done some stuff in the Star Wars universe as well, and he was the one writing Hyperion for Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And Alvaro Sarasesa, who does Witchblade, that continues a storyline from the companion title The Sovereigns. The first issue of Magnus features several covers, including retailer incentive variants, and will launch in June. So relaunching in June, female Magnus robot fighter now, and she is a psychologist who works with recalcitrant AIs. So that's an interesting take to me.
It is.
When they launched, was it – it was Dynamite, but they were they doing it under the oh, it was Dynamite before. It was Gold. Was it Gold Key under Dynamite? Like, didn't they do something like a Dynamite banner did or something
the,
like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, they did the Gold Key line.
Yeah, that's what
it was. And they took all the classic
right.
Turok and all the great characters from there and kind of did something. And as you started to read it, I started to think, you know what? I'm a little more interested now. You got a female Magnus. I'll definitely give it a try. But I am so wanting it just to go back because, of course, I read Magnus and I want to enjoy the first comic book I ever read.
Now, what happened with that series? Because I remember when Magnus launched a few years ago, you were raving about that new
yep.
series. We did an Out of the Long Box on the original Magnus Robot Fighter.
Yep.
But how long did that series go? Did it last a while?
The one that we're talking about is when Dark Horse did it and Jim Shooter was writing it.
Maybe
that's very early on in our Secret Identity career. And when that book came out, that was so good right out of the gate. That was everything I read as a kid, everything I wanted. It was basically like they took the Gold Key Whitman run and just continued it, much like G.I. Joe, America's Greatest Hero.
Right, Real American Hero.
Real American Hero. Yeah. It was that. It was right. It was, we're just going to continue the story. And all of a sudden, that line lost steam, and then Dynamite picked it up. And all of a sudden, it were the changes. And people always remember the Valiant line with the – a lot of people kind of peg that as the reason comic books ended, or the boom ended, because there was Magnus number one and Turok number one that were up there for like $50 or $60, triple print covers, weird stuff, and that was almost the end of the run. Mm. But I have most of those great moments, but I'm really interested now if they're going to completely revamp it to the way what they just did.
And you are correct, Matthew, just to reiterate what you said. Magnus was created by Russ Manning in 1963. The character had a home initially at Gold Key, and more recent iterations were published by Valiant and Dark Horse before Dynamite relaunched the character in 2014. So, yeah, the early stuff, which was in the early days of Secret Identity, obviously then went away, and then it went over to Dynamite. So here's hoping that series is good. I'm sure we'll check out the first couple issues of that series, though. Let's see what else we have for news. Oh, let's talk about some of the shows that we're going to coming up soon, because we have, first of all, Connecticut Gamer Con, as you listen to this, which will be on Friday the 24th, I mm-hmm. believe. You are 1 week away from the weekend of Connecticut Gamer Con, taking place the first and second at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut. It is, of course, our good buddy Mitch Halleck, who is the man behind Terrificon, is putting on the first ever Connecticut Gamer Con. There are fighting game tournaments. There are old arcade games. There are plenty of different consoles. There will be the new Nintendo Switch there. You can actually win a new Nintendo Switch at that show, and we will be there as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that. My son, who is an avid gamer as well, is extremely excited about that. And I'm interested to see how that show in the same space as Terrificon, how it looks, how it operates.
Yeah.
It's the first year of the show. We talked about that. So that is happening next weekend. And then it's pretty much full throttle from there.
Yeah, we have Super Mega Fest, which is happening on April 7th, 8th, and 9th. I will be there 7th and 8th. So I was going to talk to you, Brian, about maybe if you want to go on the 9th and have a table and hang out with some celebrities.
At the Super Mega – well, I get to hang out with a celebrity every Thursday.
Yes, you do. These are other celebrities.
It's the guy I'm looking at right now.
Yes, these are the other celebrities. And then on April 22nd, a show I'm very much looking forward to, AvonCon 2017.
I am super looking forward to that because we're both doing panels at that show. It's in a library, which I absolutely love. I'm hoping that it's going to be like a great family show,
yeah,
and they're going to get a good turnout that day. And the theme for Avon Con this year is villains.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping we'll see some great cosplays. I'm going to be doing a panel about creating a villain. You're going to be doing a Doctor Who panel there. Very exciting stuff. And if you are anywhere near the neighborhood of Avon, Connecticut, you should absolutely make your way down there.
And, you know, it started me thinking a lot about villains because obviously you said the theme of it is the villains. Rise of the Villains, I believe, is sort of the call tag for it. But I started to think about what is it that makes great villains? And for me, I'll just throw this one out here because I know you and I are a little different with when you think of a villain. I think you might think of a singular person, but I tend to go to the Planet of the Apes, Cylons from Battlestar Galactica, Stormtroopers, Cybermen, Daleks, the kind of entity that comes at you in waves and doesn't stop.
Uh-huh.
That is, to me, the classic villain. Like, I don't look at Darth Vader so much as a villain. I look at him more as a character, a bad character, bad guy. But it's the Stormtroopers. It is the Sand People. It's all those ones that are in groups that
So it's like the impossible odds and the overwhelming nature of the enemy that that to you makes a good villain.
Yes. Like, it's just never going to stop.
Right.
It's never, ever, ever going to stop. Mm-hmm. And gorillas on horseback with machine guns. After you take care of 20 or 30 of them, there's still a million more coming after you and you got nowhere to go.
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about villains. Maybe we'll do a segment in the near future featuring comics that include some of our favorite villains. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, for me, the best villains are the villains who are the hero of their own story. You know, the villains who think that they're the main character.
Yeah.
And that what they're doing is for all the right reasons, and they've rationalized their actions to themselves. And so they have a compelling story of their own. Dr. Doom, fantastic villain. Norman Osborn, fantastic villain. Darth Vader, as you mentioned.
I mean,
we basically had a whole prequel trilogy about Darth Vader's origin story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, regardless of the fact whether you like those movies or not, the fact that that character is so compelling that he got that much attention paid to his story, I mean, it makes him this iconic villain.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And like Lex Luthor, another great one, who if you look at the world through Lex's eyes, he's the hero.
He's fine. Everybody else are the wrong
ones. Right. He's the one who he's acting in the best interest of everyone because they just don't get it.
Yep.
And he has to protect humanity and all that kind of stuff. So.
And you always talk about the fact that when you bring it up to the horror villains like Jason and Freddy, they're just killing bad people. They're killing all the sinners and bad people.
I mean, some could say that they're angels from heaven, Matthew.
Yep.
Because, you know, in the case of Jason, he is punishing people who make bad decisions.
Yep.
People who are using illicit substances. People who are in places where they're not supposed to be. People who are having inappropriate relationships.
Yep.
All of that kind of thing. Jason comes along, he corrects the problem. And so in his mind, angel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Other people might see him as a devil incarnate.
Yep.
I mean, so, but hey, through his eyes, through his one good eye.
There we go. Perfect.
He's good. You know, and he is righting an injustice that was done to him when he was a child.
Yep.
When the camp counselors, who were not paying attention because they were busy fooling around and doing stuff they weren't supposed to be doing, basically let him drown.
Yes. Not good.
And so, you know, that's what happens. So yeah, I look forward to that discussion. Those are always fun discussions to have. I hope there's lots of people that come out for that event. So.
And another show just to mention, HVComicCon.com, Hudson Valley Comic Con happening May 6th and 7th. I believe that is the weekend of Free Comic Book Day.
It absolutely is, Matthew.
And they had that last year at the same time. And what was great was a lot of the local stores donated a bunch of the free comics to the people that were in attendance at Hudson Valley. It's a show that I had a blast at last year. I'm really looking forward to getting back. And I hate to say, apparently, any chance I get to go to Poughkeepsie, New York, I'm going to Poughkeepsie, New York.
There's nothing wrong with Poughkeepsie, Matthew.
Great little town.
I will be in Springfield, Massachusetts on Free Comic Book Day because the Forest Park Library, branch of the Springfield Library, rather, is going to be having a Free Comic Book Day event. So I will be hanging out there on Free Comic Book Day. And that reminds me, we should probably scrounge together some comic books to give out on Free Comic Book Day.
We absolutely should. I've got some upstairs.
Fantastic. So there you go. That's some of the news. Oh, one last thing. I wanted to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners, Vanessa, who reached out to me this week on via email to find an old episode of Secret Identity. And I get these emails every now and again of like, hey, I know you guys did this interview with so-and-so back then. This one was about our friend Dan McKinnon. She said, hi, I was going through your podcast archives for a particular issue and thought you might be able to help me. It would have come out sometime around July of 2015. She said, forever ago, I know. You talked about a comic book, From the Ashes. I am a huge fan of the comic and listened to the podcast when it first came out, and I was hoping to listen to it again. But for the life of me, I can't seem to remember what number it was. Obviously, I don't expect you to remember the exact number, but maybe a general idea of where to look. So the cool thing about that is, and thank you for reaching out, Vanessa, is that Drive-Thru Comics has our back.
Yes,
so this is basically a live ad read for Drive-Thru Comics right now, because for those that don't know, on Podomatic, which is our host for Secret Identity, we only have about 60 to 65 episodes of the show in rotation at any given time. So, of course, when we are now in the 760s, there are 700 episodes that are not currently up at secretidentity.podomatic.com. And so the first thing I always do is I type in either the name of the creator or I type in the name of the book and Secret Identity podcast, and usually something will pop up. And usually the first thing that pops up is a link to Drive-Thru Comics, where we have been putting our show up since about episode 250 or something like that. And so sure enough, over on drivethroughcomics.com, there was the episode that she was speaking of, which I believe was episode number 675. And you can download all of our episodes for free over at drivethroughcomics.com. And if you go over there and you find an episode that you want to download, you know, pick up some comics as well, because that is a great platform to showcase indie comics. And they also have a lot of the bigger publishers that are also part of the platform now as well.
So, and our books as well.
That's true. I'm a terrible at plugging your own stuff.
I'm looking up going, he's going to read the next line.
Yes.
Our books are there too.
Our books are there too. And thank you for reminding me, because I also forgot to mention that I, much like you did with your Doctor Who book, I recently did an update of my podcast book, Making Ear Candy. And the amazing Chris Giarrusso is doing the cover for this second edition of the book. And I have seen the final cover design.
Oh boy.
And it is tears of joy.
Excellent. I cannot wait to see it.
Tears of joy. If you like what he did with our Secret Identity banner, you will love the cover of this new book. So I'll post it when it comes up. But yeah, forever forgetting to promote our stuff, my stuff, any of that stuff. So
and it's always fun with people that – like you're using Chris for the cover of the new podcast book. I'm using our good friend Andrew Edge, who we've known for years and years and years. To do my UFO book. And what was great was I went to see Uli John Roth a couple weeks ago in Poughkeepsie. He used to be the guitar player for Scorpions. And I showed him the book. We got a picture on my Facebook page of he and I in the book. And he looked at it and he was like, this is so cool. He's German. Where's Michael Schenker? And I'm like, well, he's in here. You got to look way down here. No, he should be up in the front. Where's Schenker? He kept going on and on and on about the guy he basically replaced in Scorpions all those years ago.
Uh-huh.
So it is fun. And he kept telling me how great the cover looked. So I get to see the guys in UFO next week. And I'm hoping to be able – I'm going to give them poster copies of the book, of the cover, and I have at least the preview book that they can look at too.
Yeah, and my thought about doing books and comics and stuff now is that I am going to support, and I have been doing this, people that we know. So artists that we know, writers that we know, and so I've done that with my horror books and now with this too. And having Chris Giarrusso work with us in any capacity is always a joy. I absolutely love that guy.
Yep.
So I cannot wait for that new thing to come out. So there you go. That's the news. Also, let's give one more plug to our sponsor from Viking Oils, LLC.com. Of course, Viking Oils getting us through these dry, harsh winters here in Massachusetts. And even though spring is coming, I don't know that I'm ready to let go of my beard yet.
It hasn't even warmed up enough. I think we had 2 or 3 days where everybody got a little crazy. I went out and did some yard work. And then 3 days later, I am now shoveling. I'm trying to find the shovel that is buried under 2.5 feet of snow.
Yeah. It's been a little bit crazy here.
So we have had some dry weather that isn't great for the skin, because I've noticed I have a few dry – like I have a weird dry patch on my hip or on my side.
I don't know that we need to hear about that.
And, you know, you get them on your face, and again, that was the reason
– You're not putting beard balm on your hip now, are you?
Well, I probably
did you
should.
Find another use for Viking oils? Is that what you're saying?
Have.
Is that you're – it's becoming like – it's like snake oil now? You could cure a variety of ills with it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's just snake oil.
Yeah. All right.
And it's –
We should tell those guys. They should market it as sort of a cure-all.
It's a balm.
Yeah.
But it's great stuff. And, you know, especially with the weather changing and you never know what you're going to get. It's going to be hot. It's going to be cold. You got to need keep that skin protected underneath.
Yep. There you go. VikingOilsLLC.com. And there is always a link on the front page of our website and in the show notes as well. So there you go. Let's talk about comics, Matthew. Let's start off with a book from a guy that we both know.
Yes. And a guy that you just saw.
I did just see him. I went to see Overkill in concert on the 10th of March at the Worcester Palladium, which is one of my favorite places to see a live show. And our good friend George O'Connor and his band Swarm of Eyes were playing in they were one of the openers there. And unfortunately, I couldn't get out of work early enough to see their set, which I was super bummed about. But I did catch George over at his merch table, and I did pick up the new Swarm of Eyes EP, which I am enjoying now and will probably be speaking about in the near future. And we hung out for a little while and talked. And you are now holding his latest comic book project, which is called Silent Night.
Yes, this was something that George was very excited to get into my hands a couple weeks ago when I saw him at the Northeast Comic Con. So this is written by George O'Connor, script and letters. Dafu Yu is the penciler and inker. Leslie Klansky is the colorist, and Beth Scorzato is the editor. So it says here, story by Joseph Bouvet, George O'Connor, and Tony DeMuro, based on the characters are created by Joseph Bouvet. Homelesscomics.com, check out more. So we start out, and it says December 22nd, one day before Thanksgiving. It's around the holidays, and it looks like a cold outside cityscape. And you're seeing this guy walking in an alley, and it doesn't look very safe. And he reaches into his pocket and pulls out a list. And he's looking at it, and it's a picture of a young girl. And he's looking, and you finally get to see who this guy is. And he almost looks like, I'll show you, Brian, but he almost looks like Green Arrow back in the old days when he used to wear the hood.
Yeah.
A big, thick hood over him.
Looks like Ollie.
Yes. And you know what? You can almost say the Warlord, because it's the same color hair. It's grayish hair underneath. And he goes up to this really seedy-looking place, and he's like, looking for some holiday cheer, buddy? And he goes, no, I'm full of it. And he's like, I'm here to come in. And he's like, oh, you're funny, old man. I'll be watching you. And he goes in there, and you see that it is one of these clubs that you should not be going into, because whatever's going on in there is bad. And as he gets in there, he looks, kind of looks over at the guy, and he says, well, I've been watching you. And the doorman, the bouncer, gets on a little walkie and says, he's in. So you're seeing this might be kind of a little bit of a setup. All of a sudden, you turn the page, and there is a very young, attractive girl, and you see that it's sort of a strip club. Well, it's not really sort of a strip club. It's a strip club with other things going on behind the scenes. And this girl's over here going, hey, I think you got your woman right here that you need. And he's like, nah, I'm kind of looking for somebody. And he takes a picture out of this girl, and he says, I'm looking for a redhead tonight. And one of the girls there goes, oh, well, you know, I don't know her. And she gets a little nervous. And he's, you know, somebody – he goes up to the bar. The bartender says, what are you ordering? Got to order a drink. And he goes, milk. So he's saying something's a little different about this guy. Then all of a sudden, the madam of the house walks out, and she's like, oh, here I am. I didn't know I was going to have some helpers here tonight. And you see these three girls get behind her, and one of them is wearing a kimono, and she looks like she a little bit. She's got her fan, and her hair is all up, and she's got, you know, sharp-looking things in here. So you're seeing that the women here, there's one that's dressed in sort of bondage wear, another girl in a schoolgirl outfit with a shotgun and a baseball bat. And you're seeing that these women may not necessarily be the women that are on attraction at this place. They look like they could be bad guys. So all of a sudden, for the next three pages, you've got Santa drinking down his milk, looking at the madam, and saying, you know, I'm looking for a girl, and I know you have her. And then before she says, she's like, ladies and gentlemen, this guy's made his choice. Let him pay the price. So you see these three girls go at him. And the first one to go at him is the girl in the schoolgirl outfit. She goes there, and he's smacking her and hitting her. And he's not, like, beating her up, but every time she attacks him, he defends himself. He smacks her down and keeps telling her, he's like, you know, I don't want to do this. And you're a good girl deep down. You need to get out of here and fix this. So every time he punches him or hits him, he's giving him a little bit of a life lesson. Now the next one comes at him, the dominatrix, and she's trying to hit him with a whip. And when he's got her kind of close, he's telling her, you know, again, you don't have to do this. You need to just run away from this. You can go home. The girl in the kimono comes out and slashes at him. And then the two of them are attacking him at the same time and saying, you know, you were never one of the good ones, Winnie. So he obviously knows these girls. And now you're kind of putting two and two together. I know how he knows these people. I know why he's drinking milk. I know why he's got a beard. And then he opens up his coat as he's looking at the girl that he kind of just pushed down into some chairs. And you see he's got a red sweatshirt, red hoodie underneath it. And somebody grabs a bottle, smacks him over the back of the head. And she says, haven't you heard? Milk makes strong bones. And then he headbutts her, knocks her down. And he's like, Rachel, it's never too late to get off the list. Where's the girl? And she's down on the floor holding her nose, and she's like down the hall, down to the left. And then after some really kind of violent moments, it is really sad because he kind of puts his hand on her head, on her face, kind of caressing it and telling her, saying, that's good. Thank you, Rachel. And says, you know, I think you need to get out of here now. So you saw that she was really remorseful. He was remorseful. And then looks at this crowd that is now gathering around, seeing that there is a guy just beating up women, not knowing the whole story. And he looks over and says, I can give out a few more lumps if you need it. Everybody clears out of the club. He goes in, he kicks down the door, and he sees this young girl sitting on a bed. There's bottles and heroin needles and stuff all over the place. And she looks up and she goes, you're real. And he puts his hand out and he grabs her and he's carrying her out and she's crying. And, then you see sort of the rest of the story where a guy's going, boss, I got bad news. He took out all of the muscle there at the club. We need to figure this out. And you see that there is sort of a kingpin behind this whole thing, and that Santa is not necessarily just taking out one club looking for one person. He's been doing this everywhere, trying to right a lot of wrongs, trying to fix a lot of people. And this guy here is not very happy about the fact that he is going to lose all of his business. He's going to lose everything. So he is now plotting and planning, and he says, you know what? I'm going to make you and I'm going to make my family a promise. This will be a year without Santa Claus. And you turn the page and you see that Santa's got his jacket on around the girl's shoulders, and they're walking away behind police cars where everybody's getting taken out of there. And then it says, next issue, closed for the season. Then you get a few pages of George's plans, some of the sketches that are in here by Dafu Yu, some histories of the characters, and then you get some of George's script with the pencils. So you get to see how this thing all came together. You see, and I love things like this, where you see the pencils and inks, then you see the colors, and then you see it added with some of the word balloons in there. So a really, really, really fun story. This was not what I expected. I didn't know what to expect. To be honest, I never put two and two together until he ordered the milk and thought, oh, it's Santa Claus. I thought it was just some dude, you know, looking for his daughter or something, going on a vengeful
tour. I thought it was Green Arrow's cousin for a little while.
I thought it was. So homelesscomics.com, you can find out about Baby, you can find out about Healed, and you can add Silent Night to that list of amazing properties.
Do we know when the second issue is coming out?
I don't, because this was a convention issue, and I don't know which convention this was a convention issue for.
We'll check in with George and we'll find out.
Let me take a look. You know, it might even have March 2017.
Well, there you go.
Wow, so we're ready.
So we're ready for issue number two. We are going to go over to Image/Top Cow now and talk about the brand new Magdalena series.
Interesting.
Now, did you read Magdalena back in the day?
I've got quite a few of them.
Do you really? Okay, well, maybe you'll appreciate this then. This was never a book I picked up, but any chance to get in on the ground floor of a new edition or a new reimagining, I want to take. So, written by Teenie Howard and Ryan Cady, art by Christian DeBarry, colors by Mike Spicer, letters by Troy Pateri, and the design by Vincent Valentine. The editor is Ashley Victoria Robinson on this one. And it says, since the Dark Ages, the church has named one woman of each generation, has armed one woman of each generation with the Spear of Destiny, a relic said to have pierced Christ's side at the crucifixion, and called her the Magdalena. Legend claims that theirs is the blood of divine descendants of Jesus, the Nazareth, and the lost apostle, Mary Magdalene. With the blood of Magdalene in their veins and the blood of Christ as their weapon, they suffer no demon or beast to live. But the power of faith is belief, and no one believes in demons anymore, do they, Matthew?
Mm-mm.
So as we turn the page, we see someone's narrating, saying most of you think that evil is just an idea. Maybe you think that it's a thing people can do, or if you're a cynic, a thing maybe even people are, but that's not evil. That's not the real evil anyways. Real evil is a thing you can reach out and touch, and a thing that can reach out and touch you. And you see in this underground cavern that there is a cult of demon worshipers who are doing a summoning ritual. And they summon this demon, and as they're doing that, who is approaching from a nearby hallway but Patience, the Magdalena, current bearer of the Spear of Destiny. And she bursts into the rooms, and the guys are saying, oh, she's breached the defenses, and she comes flying in, and she's like, it smells like sulfur in here. You guys are doing another summoning, fourth in a decade. So this is the fourth in a decade of major demons that they're trying to summon into the world. So she comes in, she starts kicking the crap out of those guys, and she's like, one of the guys is like, stay back, hag. She's like, hag, I'm 32. Then she's fighting this guy, and all of a sudden, the demon starts crawling out of this pit. and his name is Marcosius. And as she is getting ready to battle him, he's saying, you know, as I name thee Magdalene, come into the circle and greet me. And so they start getting into it, and she goes to strike him, and he kind of knocks the spear away, the spear of destiny. And she's like, how did that happen? And he says, your weakness is how. This trinket's mere touch is no longer the a bane to my kind, not in this faithless age. It's when you grow so weak. And so what he's basically explaining to her is that her own faith is wavering, and the faith of mankind in general is pretty much broken at this point. And so this weapon is no longer as powerful because the person wielding it is no longer as faithful. And so she kind of ends up getting her butt kicked and gets wounded. She goes back home and she's saying how her wounds are not healing in the way that they used to heal more quickly before. And, you know, she's watching the news on television and things are not in a good place. And now all of a sudden we cut over to Anaheim, California, and you have a young woman who's having a conversation with her mom, and her mom is saying, you know, it's Wednesday, you're coming to Mass. And she's saying it, you have to go. And she's fighting with her mom about not wanting to go to Mass. And so she ends up leaving the house and getting into the car with her friend, and they're going to go meet this guy at a club. And it looks like she is either in high school or maybe recently out of high school or something, but she's living at home. And so she meets up with a friend and they're going to go to this club, and you see that she has some kind of either birthmark or some kind of mark on her forearm, which I'm assuming is the mark of Magdalene. But they end up going to this place called the Black Vault. And when they get there, you see that the Black Vault, much like the club that you mentioned, Matthew, in the book that you just talked about, it's a place that maybe people shouldn't be hanging out.
Yep.
Because one of the people there seems to be a demon, and he has been infecting some of the patrons of the club, including the young man that our new hero is going to meet. And her name is Maya. So the guy that Maya is going to meet there with her friend has been sort of half possessed by this demon guy. And you see that when he comes walking out of the club and he's like, oh, what are you doing here? And she's like, oh, well, I came down to meet you here. And they assume that he's been drinking because he's like getting sick and he's vomiting over in the corner. And they're thinking he's had too much to drink and they're going to get out of there with him. But as they're walking away, they notice that he's got a bandage on his arm. And when she lifts it up, it's like this brand that he now has on his arm. And when she lifts the bandage off, a fly kind of flies away out of it. And they're thinking, you know what, it'll be, once we get you out of here, everything will be better. So they start walking away with him. They go down to a local diner. And as they're about to sit down, all of a sudden, this guy completely, his body starts contorting and spasming. And all of a sudden, all these flies start flying out of his body. So it wasn't that he drank too much. It's that he's possessed by evil. Yes. At this point. So he's on the ground sort of flipping out. And all of a sudden, Patience, the Magdalena comes in. She comes in with the spear and she's saying, get out of the way. And Maya's saying, what the heck is happening here? She whips out the spear. She's going to fight with this guy. But again, she gets knocked aside because she's just not in a place right now where her faith is strong enough. But Maya picks up the spear of destiny, and she is able to completely destroy this thing, which ends up looking like Swarm from the old Spider-Man cartoons. Mm. It all the flies come together in this thing swarming, and she ends up taking this thing out. And all of a sudden, Magdalena says, well, what are you doing? And she says, well, I grabbed the spear and the power went through me and I took this thing down. And she says, well, my name's Patience and I'm the Magdalena, or maybe I was the Magdalena. And she starts to realize that maybe her faith is waning and her power and her time as the Magdalena is coming to an end. However, she's also starting to think that maybe this is a new person that she should be training to become the new Magdalena. And so that's the way the first issue ends, with her kind of deciding, I need to find a successor for when I can't do this anymore, which seems like that's coming up pretty quick. Maybe it's this girl. And that's the way the first issue ends. And then you get sort of a history of the Magdalena in the back of it. You get some of the concept sketches, like you mentioned in George's book there, some of the designs for the demon and stuff like that. And so I think it's a fine entry point for anybody who either has read the old books and wants to jump in on this new chapter, or somebody who's not familiar with it at all, like me. I jumped in and it's pretty easy to follow. So, and it seems to be setting up for a good story. Very dark, not super gory though, other than, you know, the one, the fly stuff, which was kind of gross, but it's not gratuitous, I didn't think.
Yeah, and it never was. It was never, I mean, the Magdalena is a very sexy looking character. And it was definitely a lot of cheesecake.
And I don't know if that's the case. So maybe that was the case back in the old books, but certainly in this one here, like her outfit and her, you know, her sort of superhero uniform is much less inappropriate.
And that's good.
Like
that's
there's no cheese to that. It's just cool looking.
Because there is a lot of substance to the character. It's not just one of these throwaways.
Right.
So speaking of throwaways, and I'm saying that in a not throwaway kind of thing, is what I think to me is my favorite comic book in the last year, and that is The Flintstones. I seem to be in the minority on this one. I am constantly arguing with people, not bad arguments, but where people are saying it's garbage. I'm like, you need to read this.
Saying it's garbage without ever even having looked at it?
People have read it and don't like it, but the thing a lot of people are doing is they want their old Flintstones. And none of these books were meant to be...
No, it's like the Scooby Apocalypse one. Like they are – this whole reimagining of this line was done to be very different than the cartoons that we grew up with.
Yeah, and Mark Russell, who's the writer, Steve Pugh is the artist, Chris Chukri is the colorist, Dave Sharp is the letterer. What Mark has done in every single issue is tells a story of something going on in modern times and kind of Flintstones it. Like there's been a ton of things in here about religion and following that one true God, because in this issue they're on like their eighth God that they're following. And then there was another one with a presidential election that was very much influenced by what it went on in our insane political period of a few months ago. But in number 9, the name of the story is A Basket of Disposables. And what this is sort of a cry out to the disposable world we live in, how we don't become attached to things anymore, and how people have even become disposable in a way. And we start out where they're going to church, and it's now a church that has been replaced, and it's now the church of Vorp. And Vorp is the new god, and they're praying, and, you know, oh, praise Vorp. And Vorp is like this huge serpent that freaks out and scares everybody. It's not the happy god that they've wanted. So that's where it ends, and you see everybody afterwards sitting around going, well, you know, I kind of feel bad about that. That kind of scared more of the parishioners than it did help them. And the most of the group in there are all people that were former gods, like maybe a year ago, 6 months ago, they were a god. But you do have Mr. Slate in there. But Mr. Slate got something out of that. And what he got out of that was he needs to do what's right for everybody, although it may not be a popular decision. And that's what we think about a lot in this world that we live in, making that popular decision or the unpopular decision for the greater good. But the story sort of starts out on here where you have the elephant who's the dishwasher. You've got the crane who's the lamp. You've got the armadillo who's a bowling ball. And the bowling ball and the dishwasher have become very good friends. And they're talking about, you know, what's going on. And that's when at night when nobody's using it, this is where all the appliances get together and they have their talk. So back the next day at the gravel pit, Mr. Slate is talking about taking this company to the next level, to really bringing it in. And are you with me? And everybody is freaking out going, yeah, we're with you. We're with you. And then he goes, gentlemen, you've been replaced. And you see that it is a bunch of Neanderthal looking cavemen and a bunch of gorillas. And they're like, what are you talking about? We agreed with you. And he says, yeah, you agreed, but I can pay for one of you. I can get like 10 of these guys. And you know what? If they get killed, no big deal. There's another one to replace them. And so they're all now out of a job. And Fred's now at home, really upset, depressed. And Wilma's like, you know what? Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. And you see on the news talking about the fact that there's been massive layoffs because there's only one company in this place, and they've now laid everybody off. So Fred's like, I'm going out. Doesn't matter where I go. And to make him happy, Wilma goes out and buys him a brand new bowling ball, which is an armadillo, and has his name engraved on it. But there it's not engraved. It's painted on. So it just says Fred. So she gives it to him. He's like, oh, you're the greatest. And she goes, and you know what? Let's just get rid of this old bowling ball. So she throws the old armadillo away. And at night, you've got all the animals are coming out. And then you're seeing that he realized the washing machine, and it's that elephant that they use the trunk and squirt.
Right.
The elephant's looking out the window going, bowling ball, what's going on? And sees bowling ball going in the trash and driving away. And, you know, so now he's all upset, and he's like, hey, can I come out of here? Can I talk to somebody? I'm really upset. And you see all the other appliances are all just sleeping because Fred's hanging out so much they can't be themselves. So they're all tired all the time. So now you've got Mr. Slade who's driving around impressing his new girlfriend. And as he's going through, you're seeing all these people that are living in the streets. They've got boxes on them or they've got animal skins and they're living there. And Mr. Slade's girlfriend is like, wow, what are all these people? And he's like, well, those were my former employees apparently, but I got rid of them because I wanted to make the bottom line better. And I thought that this is what you might want. And she says, you know what, I'm kind of disgusted by this and I'm not too thrilled about this. And she leaves him. So now he starts realizing maybe I ought to bring everybody back. And now all the animals are talking with the elephant saying, you know, what's going on? What's the matter? And Dino comes walking in. And so when Dino walks in, he's speaking language like they are, not just the yip, 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 yip. But these guys, all the appliances, don't like Dino because he's a pet. He doesn't have to work. He doesn't have to work for anything. So they're like, oh, yeah, Dino's here. Let's just not talk. So they kind of blow him off. They go out and they go to the recycle center to see if they can find the old bowling ball. They find the old bowling ball. They get all the bowling ball back. But you see when they're there, it's a whole bunch of dead animals just lying around there because that's what all the appliances are. So it's kind of that thing of, you know, everything may be disposable, but there's a price to pay for all the disposable stuff. I read these comics and I start really cringing at some of the things that I might do. You know, I start looking at what I'm going to throw away. And especially with this one. So they get the bowling ball out. Mr. Slate brings everybody back to the quarry. And then it is happiness, happiness right over there. So everybody's doing their thing and living their life. But on the last page, they're talking about that they can't find Dino. And it's a funeral for a friend. And Dino is tied up by all the other animals in the closet. So we don't know what's going to happen with that one. But as I said, this is a book that definitely writes itself a lot deeper and a lot more in tune with what is going on in the world. And when I try to explain that to people, they just don't want that. They would rather have this be called something else. But if it wasn't called The Flintstones, I probably wouldn't be reading it. So I'm telling you, take a chance, pick up an issue. The trade, I think the trades are now out for all of the Hanna-Barbera books. Plus, they've
what
got,
number is that now?
This
nine.
Is number nine. So they also have a huge Hanna-Barbera event coming up next month, which I'm very excited about. But definitely pick up the Flintstones. Just give it a try.
So we're going to stay with DC, Matthew, and we're going to stay on the maybe the outskirts of some of the big superhero books. And we're going to talk about Gotham Academy number seven. Now, Gotham Academy, when we had the end of last season, if you will, the first semester, where it was a bunch of anthology issues. And then with the sort of first issue that felt like it was a holdover issue to start this one, I felt like the book was losing a little momentum. The past few issues have been absolutely amazing. And this one in particular makes the winter issue completely make sense now. And so what's been happening is a couple things. Number one, their friend Colton is about to get expelled from Gotham Academy. And so there was a hearing to see whether or not he should be expelled. And Pommeline's mom is a lawyer. And so she's come to help with that hearing that was going on. But in the middle of it, Pommeline ended up stealing a map to a secret location on campus. Colton left in the middle of his hearing and the kids are scattered all over the place because what we've seen is that there has been this thing that Pommeline has been searching for called the Book of, I think it's the Book of Old Gotham. And she's found out where it is. And so that's what's kind of been going on is that she is trying to find this. And it's in this it's basically in this underground layer underneath the campus of Gotham Academy. And so they've been going after that. But there's been another kid by the name of Eric who has also been looking for this book. And now the two of them have gotten into it. And but the core gist of this book is what's been going on with Olive, because we've seen a lot of her new roommate who has been this very negative influence on her, this girl Amy, who came in during the winter break when no one else was there. That was the issue that I talked about here on the show and how she had her throwing rocks at windows and basically making her feel like she didn't need any of her other friends and they were abandoning her and all this kind of stuff. Well, all of that comes to a head in this issue. Now, the issue is written by Brendan Fletcher, Becky Cloonan, and Carl Kerschel. The script itself, or the story was, the script itself is Brendan Fletcher, Adam Archer, and Masazik do the pencils, and Sandra Hope and Masazik do the inks, and Masazik does the colors. And Steve Wands does the letters, Carl Kerschel the cover, and the editor is Rebecca Taylor. And what has happened at the end of the last issue is as they've gone into this underground cavern that has this big symbol on it, they have, you saw this kid, Eric, who was coming after Pommeline. And he ended up knocking their friend Tristan off the side of this platform, and Olive thought that they killed him. And Tristan is kind of like a – he's almost like the man bat.
Mm.
And so everybody here at Gotham Academy, what we're learning is they have a connection to perhaps a villainous heritage in their family or maybe a hero heritage. But there's some connection to the history of Gotham for almost every kid that goes to this school. And Tristan seems like he's kind of connected to the man bat. Olive, her mother was a villain by the name of Calamity, and she had these fire-based powers. And the fear is that Olive might develop these powers as well, and we've seen them start to develop already. So she sees her friend Tristan get knocked over by this kid, Eric, and all of a sudden her roommate, Amy, is kind of whispering in her ear, did you see what he just did? He's going to do that to the rest of your friends if you don't get in there and save them. So she goes in and she pushes this kid, Eric, off the side of the platform, seemingly to his death. And everybody else is like, holy crap, what did you just do? You killed that kid. And she's like, no, he was going to hurt all of you. And Amy told me. And everybody's like, what do you mean, Amy? And she's like, my roommate, Amy, the one that told me that, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You guys have seen her around. She's been here. And her friend Kyle goes, Olive, none of us have even met Amy yet. We couldn't even tell you what she looks like. And then Olive has this moment where she relives events of the past several issues of this book where she met Amy for the first time and Amy's given her advice over her shoulder and she kind of bullied this kid, Eric, who is the other one looking for the book, you know, before. And she's starting to question whether or not Amy was ever with her at all. And so as she's dealing with that, her powers start to flare up and she says, I have to get out of here. And she takes off. And so as she does that, she runs into one of her professors, Professor McPherson. She says, I got to go back to my room. I'm not feeling good. And she leaves. Meanwhile, you have Pommeline and Colton, who down in this underground cavern are going to continue the search for this book that she was looking for. So they go searching for this book because apparently it has like the basically the history of Gotham in it. And so they're looking for that. Meanwhile, Olive goes back to her room and she's looking around and her roommate's clothes aren't there and none of her belongings are there. And so she's starting to wonder if this person was ever real at all. And all of a sudden, Amy shows up in her room and she's like, who are you? And Amy's like, who do you think I am? I'm your roommate or maybe your soulmate. Either way, you know, I'm with you all the time now. And we start to realize that the only one that could see Amy is Olive. And as that conversation is happening, you have Pommeline and Colton who find this huge chamber with all these treasure in it and everything like that. But in the middle of this chamber is this old book. And when she sees it, it's the Book of Gotham. And she picks it up and she starts reading it. And the person who is writing it is saying all this different stuff. But he essentially talks about the Silverlocks being connected to the Arkhams. And what it ends up meaning is that Olive is an Arkham. Mm. And there was once an Arkham named Amity Arkham. And we turn the page and we see that Amy, the roommate of Olive, is like the ghost of Amity Arkham, who has been haunting her and almost possessing her and forcing her to use her powers and stuff like that. So she's completely distraught. She runs out of there and she runs to go find her professor, who is the only person she feels like she can trust. And when she sees her, her professor is having a conversation with Batman, like in the shadows, saying, I think something's happening with Olive. I think that what we feared happening is starting to happen now. And Batman saying, yeah, they kept mentioning this Amity girl, but I always thought it was that her mother was delusional. Maybe there is something to it. We need to find out more about it. And Olive's realizing that they've had all these conversations about her and they've had all these suspicions about her and no one has shared any of those things with her. And she starts to lose control of herself and she starts to turn into kind of the villain that her mother used to be. And that's the way the issue ends, is that she's about to unleash her fire powers on Batman and on her professor and on the whole campus. And that's the way the issue ends. And so it took a while to pay that off. But now that they did, I almost feel like the wait was worth it because the roommate thing, who I was like, this is kind of weird. Like, where is she coming from? It all makes sense now. It all clicks now. So not only are you getting, you know, underground dungeon crawls with treasure at the end of it and old lore of Gotham with secrets of all these different families, but you're getting an appearance by Batman and you're getting all of these characters who could be villains, but they might help, but I don't know. But it's that whole almost like Scooby-Doo-ish sense of mystery that hooked me to Gotham Academy in the first place, that brought me right back in now. And there is a first of all, the artwork is simply amazing in this book. And again, the artists have changed a couple times because I think Carl Kerschel was drawing
the initial artist.
Yep. It's been very consistent. I mean, there are times where Adam Archer and Misasik's pencils look like his stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a very sort of Don Bluth feel to the look of this book, especially when it's in motion and there's action happening and stuff like that. And it is really just a joy to read. So Gotham Academy is fully back in.
Excellent.
You know, a top five spot on the books that I read each month. And this issue is a real turning point issue. So definitely worth picking up. Well, those are our comics for this week, and that brings us to our final segment of the day, which is Liner Notes, the segment where we talk about the music that we are listening to. And this week, we have listened to an album that drops, as you listen to this show, today.
And that's always fun when we get to hear something before the rest of the world does.
Yes, it is the new House of Lords album called The Saint of the Lost Souls, and it is – what I didn't realize about these guys when I sort of looked back at their history – 1987.
Yeah, so I had this whole history thing that I was looking at, and it was funny because – so 1988, the first House of Lords album came out. It was the first release on Simmons Records, which was Gene Simmons' record label. The only other band that he had any legs with on that release was Firehouse.
Yep.
Because they were a Simmons band. House of Lords came out of the ashes of Jafria. Jafria was a band that was formed by Greg Jafria after he left Angel, which was a big 70s band. And – Jafria had two albums out that I really loved. I thought they were great. They had a couple hit singles. Call to the Heart was probably their biggest one. So when the band kind of fragmented, James Christian came in. They rechristened as a House of Lords and released two albums. The House of Lords was the first one, Sahara the second. They released a third, but the second one was the one that after I remember getting that one, that was almost when, to me, music started to kind of fall.
Uh-huh.
The metal thing started to kind of die out. I just got sober, so I was like not even listening to anything. So I kind of stayed away from them for a long time. But I came back in about 2010, 2011, went back and got a lot of their back catalog. But this is the seventh album with the James Christian, Jimmy Bell, BJ Zampa lineup. And their music up until – I mean, from when they came in, they've always had – it's almost like if you had to pick a style, it would almost be like a rocky steampunk. They wore the Victorian stuff, like the long frills, which I absolutely love that. Their music has a sort of a majestic quality to it, much like Europe and Deep Purple, bands that we always talk about. And when I listened to this album, Jimmy Bell was telling me earlier saying, yeah, they wanted to kind of go back to that more classic sound of the House of Lords, because the last two albums leading into this one were a little more guitar driven.
Uh-huh.
So they added the keyboards, which when you tell somebody that loves hard rock and heavy metal, when you hear somebody say something like, we're going to add a lot more keyboards than we had before, your first thought is, uh-oh, this isn't going
to
be good.
Well, it depends. You know, as I was listening to this album, and I really enjoyed this album overall,
yeah.
And I think about this concept a lot because I talk a lot about music now, and you and I talk a lot about music when we're not recording the show, is that there are so many different slices of rock slash metal, right? And these guys fit, to me, squarely in the melodic rock realm. There are times where their music is more towards the hard rock, even bordering on metal side. And there are times where it's almost more on the pop rock side. But with on this album in particular, a heavy emphasis on keyboards that really add a sense of atmosphere to the songs and add a sense of depth and another layer to the songs. And I do know that some people kind of shy away from that. But you mentioned Europe's a great example of that, right? So that was one thing that made Europe stand out from a lot of the bands of that time was their emphasis on the keyboards. Mm-hmm. Dio used a lot of keyboards.
Yeah.
When I saw Dio in concert, that was a thing that jumped out at me is how much keyboards and synthesizers were there when he played live and stuff like that too. So, you know, for me, it's all about what you come to the table expecting. And I think with House of Lords, you're coming to the table expecting that mix of melodic rock, sometimes harder, sometimes a little bit on the softer side, and a good, you know, sense of keyboards within it as well. So to me, they delivered on what you would pick up a House of Lords of album for. You know what I mean? Like, if you're picking up a House of Lords album, this is what I would want out of that. And as I listen to it, it's an extremely listenable album that has 11 tracks, and they kind of hit to all fields, but within this pocket where it all fits together very well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are times where I'm thinking to myself, man, this is like AC/DC and Kix, or man, this sounds like David Lee Roth's solo stuff. Or, you know, this stuff sounds like Adrenalize era Def Leppard sort of stuff. And so, but vocally and melodically, like they're just a really, this is a, what I call it nowadays is a band that just knows what the heck it's doing.
Yeah.
And that's what I see from a lot of the veteran bands that we grew up listening to that are now putting out albums in their late 50s and in their early 60s. People that just know what the heck they're doing. They can sit down as a group, put an album together, and they know their sound. They know what they're doing, and that confidence comes through on the album. And that's what I felt like when I listened to this, is these guys know what they're doing.
Yeah, and you go down the tracks, and the lineup on this one, James Christian, the lead singer and the keyboardist, except on Harlequin. I forgot who it was that played that long keyboard intro to Harlequin, which
is so, very Deep Purple.
Holy cow. The funniest thing about that song is you're hearing it, and you're like, yeah, kind of Asia, kind of progressive, kind of, you know, yes. And then all of a sudden it stops and goes right into this really heavy, heavy, heavy song.
Yep.
Jimmy Bell on guitars, BJ Zampa on drums, and their new bass player, Chris Tristram. These guys are just, they definitely, like you were saying, they hit it to all fields. The Oceans Divide is such
yes.
a beautiful song with some amazing harmonies in it. But it to me, that's the classic House of Lords sound. And when you hear that one, now you're hearing, when you hear the rest of it, it all kind of, to me, fits back into that mold of the keyboards are there. The keyboards are not necessarily driving it, but they're building the texture of what you're going to listen to.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some songs where the keyboards are sort of in the driver's seat. But I think what I like about particularly James Christian's vocals is that, you know, I mentioned Def Leppard. Def Leppard, in order to create harmonies, would essentially layer their own voices and produce them to the point where it sounded like a bunch of different people's voices.
Yeah.
Here, you can still hear the edge in James Christian's voice, even though he's capable of hitting that range. And then I'm assuming on some of the songs, and I don't have the liner notes in front of me, that they have backup singers that are also providing some melody as well. So it sounds human. It
yeah.
sounds real. And when you hear these choruses and you hear the background vocals during the verses, you know, in the background and that kind of stuff, that all sounds... It sounds great.
Yeah.
Like their melodies are fantastic. And the other standout for me from this album is Jimmy Bell's guitar playing. Like there are songs that are even some of the slower tempo, almost pop rocky sort of songs or ballady type songs. And then you get to the solo and he's just shredding.
Yeah.
I mean, he is there was a couple times where I was like, this sounds to me like Reb Beach.
Yeah.
And to me, Reb Beach is one of the greatest guitar players ever. And Jimmy Bell is nailing just all over the neck, just capturing the emotion of the song, doing a really, really good job of either driving home the heaviness of a song or like taking you in a different direction. Really great guitar work all through this album.
The song that I was excited about you hearing was Rain of Fire, because when I talked to Jimmy, I did a great couple interviews with him. One of them you can hear in the last episode of 53.5, the official Striper podcast. I've got another one coming in a couple months. But he was talking about the fact that he and BJ put together these songs, and Rain of Fire was the AC/DC sounding song.
Which you can totally hear
yep.
in the beginning of the song. It sounds like classic AC/DC, you know, riffage, a little bit of Kix thrown in there.
And then when they get it back, it's like, this is amazing, but this is not really what we thought right away.
Well, because when you get to the chorus, there's heavy,
yeah.
You know, keyboards that come in at that point, which I really like.
Yep.
But yeah, that like just a great melodic rock album from top to bottom, and as it ends, you don't mind it rolling over right and playing right again. So it's pretty much been in my CD player all week this week.
And New Day Breakin' is the one that to me is my favorite of the songs, because to me that captures that. That's the song that's hits every little wheelhouse thing that I need in my music. It's very melodic, a lot of great backing vocals, a lot of vocals that are kind of swirling. There's a bunch of the moments where, and I was trying to explain this to Jimmy, we were talking today, I go, is there a term for when the vocals go high and then you have the rhythms of the song kind of downshifting lower? And I said, that's like the magic point for me for music. And he says a lot of that is just to bring the chorus out, that it isn't necessarily thought of as like an, you know, sort of a tool.
Yeah.
Like you don't sit there and go, all right, I'm going to do this. It just sort of happens. And I love that stuff. I always describe it as downshifting a car.
I listened to this album and I immediately thought that my first listen through that this is dead center of your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Like dead center of your wheelhouse. Yep. Like it's got the elements of Asia that you like.
Yeah.
It's got the harder elements of like a Dokken that you like. Like it just is the perfect, like this is where I think our Venn diagram of listening like overlaps.
Yep.
Is that I also get a lot out of melodic rock, especially like 80s. And I think a lot of – there's so many bands that got thrown into the quote-unquote hair metal genre that has gotten a lot of stigma over the years. But there are some amazing bands, and there's also a lot more variety than people get credit for in that particular time period. And like this is a band that I feel like probably doesn't get enough credit for – the musicianship that they have, which is amazing. Like the keyboards are amazing. Whether you like keyboards or don't like keyboards, the keyboards on this album are amazing.
Yeah. It's very Deep Purple-ish, very Europe, a little bit of that Whitesnake element, maybe the slided in Whitesnake. And
oh, definitely. What song did I – what was I thinking Whitesnake? Maybe it was Concussion.
That song rocks.
Yeah.
That has got such a thumping beat to it. The other one, I'm trying to find – The Sun Will Never Rise.
Yep.
The ballad. It's just such a beautiful song. And on the Japanese import, you get a 12th song, a bonus track, which is the acoustic version of that, which
yes.
I love the acoustic version, but I almost would – and usually I like that, the acoustic versions more, but I really prefer the studio version because you're getting everybody kind of in there. You're getting all the different elements. And the more I listen to it, I've only known Jimmy Bell for maybe a couple months just chatting. But I've known of him for a while. This is the first time I've actually really sat down and thought, yeah, I don't think of this guy just as the guy who lost out to Zach Wilde for Ozzy's job anymore. I think of this guy as one of the best players out there. And he was kind of – I don't know if shredder is an insulting term to a lot of people.
Oh,
guitar
not
player,
to me it isn't.
But he was sort of that shredder guy before the shredding came in, before the Tony McAlpines, the Chris Impellitteris, before Yngwie Malmsteen. He was playing this – kind of style in Connecticut clubs where the band joined forces.
Yeah.
So great stuff. And the album is out on Frontiers Music and it comes out today as we're talking.
There you go. So that is your liner notes for this week. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast for Mr. Matthew A. Herring. This is Brian Lantendry signing off. Have a great rest of your week and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.